Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on this March 18, 2021. Currently coming to you live from Istanbul, Turkey, where the trees are already blossoming, but the weather is just as unpredictable as it is at home. So keep your umbrellas close to you, you never know when you'll need them. Announcement from the Consumer Choice Center. We just released the latest edition of the European Railway Station Index. My colleagues Maria Chaplia and Tamara Tazaitse compiled a ranking of the most passenger-friendly railway stations in Europe, evaluating the 50 largest train stations in Europe. The winner this year is Leipzig Main Station in Germany. Last place goes to the Magenta Railway Station in Paris. You can find the entire ranking under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. My guest this week is Jason Reed, a policy fellow here at the Consumer Choice Center and the UK liaison at Young Voices. We talked about the UK's obesity problems and the government's attempt to solve it. You'll hear that at the end of this episode. Also in this show, the European Court of Justice ruled that European cows are just as good as foreign cows, so we'll deep dive into what exactly that means. I'm talking to my colleague Fred Roeder about the suspension of the AstraZeneca vaccine, and Germany cuts CO2 emissions due to COVID-19. So let's get started. Milk is milk, says the European Court of Justice based in Luxembourg. In an October ruling on the case dating back to 2016, the EU's top court had decided that milk producers and retailers are not required to indicate whether their milk is from in or outside the European Union. So the French government had required producers with a national law to indicate this on their labels. But the French State Council has now struck down this legislation because of the ECJ. According to EU rules, you can only mandate these origin labels if you can argue that a consumer receives valuable information from them. So in essence, the question was, are French consumers more aware of the quality of their milk if they know it was produced in Switzerland rather than Italy? No, says the European Court in Luxembourg, milk is milk, whether it is located in Argentina or Marseille, though I assume there isn't too much fresh milk you can get from overseas. Here's a clip from the European Parliament from back in 2016 when Labour Party MEP Gelnis Wilmot was making the case for these labels.
At least member states are now waking up to this demand, with France bringing in legislation for origin labelling for milk and for meat in processed food. Italy and Portugal are also considering similar legislation. So it seems as if everyone wants this labelling except for the Commission. This is about clear, honest labelling, which doesn't mislead consumers. It would allow consumers to make informed decisions about the food they buy for a variety of reasons: environmental, animal welfare, and yes, to support their local farmers if that's what they want to do. It should be their choice. It would also be positive for the food industry and would help restore consumer confidence, which actually has been very badly damaged in recent times. So I hope MEPs will support this resolution, and I hope the Commission will finally listen to the Parliament and, more importantly, finally listen to consumers.
Now, I think this misunderstands labels for a variety of reasons. First of all, I'm a consumer myself, and I don't think we need these labels. So Ms. Wilmot is not speaking on my behalf, at least. Now, secondly, we know that the reason some countries are introducing mandatory labels is because they'd like to create a stigma against certain producers. I gave the example of Switzerland earlier, but this isn't about Switzerland. This is about Ukraine or Belarus, where we'd like to think that there are backwards processes for milk production that don't adhere to our superior European vision of food. I really think it's food elitism at its best, slapping a big label on the product to try and get you to reconsider your choices. Another point where the labelling argument fails is the question of local products. So governments, as we now know, aren't allowed to require labels. But those producers who want to slap a big label that says that your milk is French, German, and so on, are freely able to do that. And by the way, they do. Many farmers are actually happy to tell you how local their products are. And so do the retailers, by the way, who, you know, you've seen this, who often have this local food section in your supermarket to support food patriotism or whatever it is. Now, as you can probably hear from the tone of my voice, I'm not one to really prefer my local products just for the sake of it. If you want to buy local, the producers will happily tell you. We've seen that. And yes, retailers also have the ability to require from the producers to put a label on it. Because, well, the retailers, the supermarkets, are free to require and do any type of curation they want. What I don't support is the effort to stigmatize certain products just because it's foreign. In other news then, the AstraZeneca vaccine against COVID-19 is causing some concerns around Europe. I'm bringing in my colleague Fred Roeder, Managing Director at the Consumer Choice Center and German health economist, to shed some light on the recent developments. All right, Fred, so I'm reading the news and I'm seeing that some European countries are suspending the AstraZeneca vaccine against COVID-19. Why exactly is that? Is this vaccine dangerous?
What happened is that a few people had clotted blood, or called thrombosis, after receiving the AstraZeneca vaccine. It is still not clear if this happened because of the vaccine or it's just a coincidence. We're talking right now about 6 out of 1 million people who received the vaccine. If we, for instance, compare this to side effects of the proven and widely used birth control pill or different birth control pills, that side effect occurs there as well, and actually at 100 times more patients per dose. And the birth control pill or different birth control pills have not been removed from the market. So it seems to be a rather political decision that no one is daring to take any risk or responsibility for potentially something going wrong with a few people taking the vaccine. There's risk in life. And again, we still don't even know if it's just a coincidence or if actually this vaccine has caused the thromboses in these patients.
Right. So, but what exactly are the countries supposed to do? Because there's so much skepticism in certain countries in vaccines. I mean, France is a very vaccine skeptic nation. And of course, the government wants to reassure people that, of course, we're watching after your health. And I think that also caused this suspension. So what do you think is the better solution to continue vaccination quickly with this vaccine? What ought governments tell patients?
First of all, governments should trust the European Medicines Agency, which still does not see a reason to remove or halt using this vaccine. Other regulators in the world, such as the United Kingdom, have also not stopped doing it. We talk about trust by just pausing the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is a widely available vaccine compared to others because it's easier to store and manufacture. It is actually just oil in the fire of those who criticize vaccines in general. And the trust of this vaccine has been destroyed for much longer than its administration will be paused. So by pushing this political decision of halting or pausing the AstraZeneca vaccine, its reputation and trust have been sustainably damaged, which is a huge problem because the task of our governments is also to bring us back to normal. And most countries have applied the precautionary principle when it comes to COVID. Lockdowns, shutting down most of our social life, social distancing. Now we have finally vaccines that can get us back to normal, but an even stronger version of the precautionary principle is now applied that we probably will, if they continue this, and I'm laughing, but it's actually very sad, more people will die due to COVID. More people will suffer the unintended consequences of all these government measures that aim to keep us safe but cause many other problems. And our North American friends would probably call this a catch-22. It's like a problem you cannot really get out if every solution also bears like a marginal residue of risk. So what I would recommend is to governments is to say, okay, it is not really clear what caused these blood clots. If people are worried about this, they should not take the vaccine. But I just read a couple of comments online and saw some interviews with people who want to get vaccinated. And they say, I still would take the AstraZeneca shot better today than tomorrow, because every day we wait is a day too long. And these people should still have access to it because the European Medicines Agency has approved it, deemed to be safe, and patients who want it should be able to get it.
All right. So I just have one more point, and I'm not sure if you want to speak to this, but this is just out of interest. I'm reading that some people who get this particular shot or others, they feel very sick for 24 to 48 hours. Can you explain maybe to our audience why that happens? Why do people feel uneasy for some hours or maybe even days?
I have not received the AstraZeneca shot myself, but I got the Sinopharm shot and had pretty strong headache both times. And the first time, it's two shots in total. The first time I also had some muscle aches. But that is the same case if you receive a flu vaccine, which I actually do every year. It's not great how you often feel afterwards, but actually it's a sign that your body responds to it. It means it does something. And even with the very much praised BioNTech Pfizer vaccine, a friend of mine who got it, who's very perfectly fit, had chills for 2 days. But that's better than being very sick with COVID. And vaccines cause a reaction in your body. And feeling bad for a day or two is part of that. I mean, the worst vaccine I ever got was against yellow fever, a really nasty disease you don't want to contract. And I had like terrible muscle aches for 3 days and sometimes could barely stand. But this is what the vaccine does. I mean, it's supposed to protect you from a much worse thing called yellow fever, or in this case, COVID.
You can follow Fred on Twitter at Fred Cyrus Roeder. That's Fred Cyrus, C-Y-R-U-S, Roeder. In other news then, Germany is doing well on its CO2 emission targets, says a new report from its environmental agency, UBA. Emission levels fell 8.7% from 2019 levels, which represents a 40% emissions cut from 1990. That's only narrowly above the target that Germany has set itself. This reduction, of course, only possible due to the COVID-19 restrictions through reduction in transport and energy, making up a third of the reason for these reductions. In early pandemic stages, there were already those who rejoiced at the news. Here's a report from Deutsche Welle from back in April 2020.
Global economic activity has been put into an induced coma. Bad for the world economy, but from a climate perspective, the coronavirus pandemic is not entirely negative. Environmental activists might actually rejoice. Measures have been implemented immediately that drastically cut emissions, measures that otherwise would have taken years to come into effect.
Images from space. China's air pollution, shown in red, shrunk dramatically between December and March. Thick smog has given way to blue skies. Thanks to closed factories, reduced capacity power plants and fewer cars on the roads, Beijing's residents have been enjoying some unusually fresh spring air.
Notice there that at the beginning, the concept of it being bad for the world economy but good for the climate. The global economy being a footnote in the considerations of environmentalists really upsets me, because there's a certain amount of truths we really need to consider here. As societies get richer, they increase their potential to protect the environment. It turns out that the richest countries in the world are also those where consumers have the ability to look after the environment, because they can buy more innovative cars, for instance, or afford the ability to recycle. Now, as for Germany specifically, the actual culprit for increased CO2 emissions aren't its cars. Here's an extract from a TED talk from environmentalist Michael Schellenberger, who's one of my favorite people to listen to, by the way, on energy-related matters.
And here's the real shocking thing. German carbon emissions have actually been going up since 2009. They have increased over the last 2 years, and they may increase this year as well. And German carbon emissions have declined since the 1990s, but most of that is just due to the fact that after reunification, Germany just took offline all of those inefficient coal plants in East Germany. Most of that reduction is just due to that. And let's take a look at last year. One of the things that really quickly can reduce emissions is switching from coal to natural gas, because natural gas is about half of the carbon intensity of coal. And that would have resulted in a pretty significant reduction in German carbon emissions last year, except for the fact that Germany took offline nuclear, and when it did that, it meant that the emissions actually ended up going up again. Now, there's some questions about, what about the future? So if we just do more solar and wind, won't it kind of all work itself out? Well, one of the biggest challenges to this has come from somebody here in Germany who is not a pro-nuclear person at all, is an energy analyst and economist named Leon Hirth, and what he finds is that that problem I described earlier, where sometimes you have too much wind at certain parts of the day or certain parts of the year, or too much solar and not clear what to do with it, that reduces the economic value of wind and solar. So wind, actually, the value of it reduces 40% once it gets to be 30% of your electricity, And solar, it's even more dramatic. It actually declines by half when it gets to just 15%.
Again, that was Michael Schellenberger from Environmental Progress in a TED Talk titled Why I Changed My Mind on Nuclear Power, which you can find on YouTube. I much recommend it, and I hope to have Michael on the show eventually in the future. But now let's go to the interview of this week. My guest is Jason Reed, UK Policy Fellow here at the Consumer Choice Centre and UK Liaison for Young Voices. We talked about the UK's obesity problem and ways to fix it. All right, so Jason, we are talking about a difficult topic, and that is obesity being a conversation that the UK has had for a while now. We know that the Cameron government and the May government were both all about trying to tackle obesity. Just give us an impression, for you reporting from the UK, how much of an issue is obesity and how does it affect people?
Well, on the statistical side of things, it's becoming increasingly clear that Britain is facing an obesity crisis. Obesity rates are higher than they ever have been. A recent study came to the conclusion that excess body fat in the UK actually kills and has killed more people than smoking every year since 2014. It's especially pronounced in children. So it's one in five children are overweight by the time they start primary school at the age of four, and that increases to one in three by the time they leave primary school at the age of 11. So it's a very serious problem. And that's, of course, even more clear now as a result of the coronavirus crisis, because it has affected the disproportionately high death toll that the UK has seen from COVID. All the science indicates that there is a clear link between being obese and being more likely to become seriously ill or die from a coronavirus infection. The UK has had the highest death toll in Europe by some margin. And it seems like there is a clear link between the two. And as a result, perhaps unsurprisingly, it is at the top of the list for health policy reforms and is very high in priorities for this government.
Yeah, Boris Johnson has said the same. But what we've seen is that Boris Johnson has sort of shifted focus as to how he wants to exactly tackle this problem. I remember that when he first was running for leader of the Conservative Party and then Prime Minister, he seemed to be very liberal-minded in his approach, you know, personal responsibility and not sort of the regulatory approach. Just give us sort of an idea how Boris Johnson's approach was in the beginning and how we've seen it shifted.
Well, Boris Johnson, over his long political career, has always called himself a libertarian. He's always talked about values of liberty. He once called Britain the land of liberty. But that seems to have shifted in the last few years that he's been prime minister, and especially in terms of obesity policy specifically. When he was running in a few years ago for the leadership of the Conservative Party on the issue of sugar taxes, he promised to review those and to look to roll them back. He promised, the phrase he used was he wanted to roll back the continuing creep of the nanny state. But that has changed quite dramatically, especially in the last few months. In terms of what's caused that change, I would venture that perhaps more from a personal and as well as a PR point of view, it's to do with the fact that he got COVID-19 himself and he was in hospital, and there was a short period of time where his health was under some serious questions. And after that, he obviously drew the link between obesity and COVID, and I believe the phrase he used was that when he caught the disease, he was in the pink of health, except for the fact that he was too fat. So he lost some weight himself, which is great, but he managed to do it without any of the policies that he's now proposing, which makes it unclear why he now feels that the rest of the country is unable to lose weight the same way he did, and needs all of this brand new state intervention in order to help them do that.
So you talk about the policies he's suggesting. Just give us sort of an overview. What exactly is in that? What is he proposing to do to fight obesity?
Well, we have a sugar tax already, which, of course, he promised to review, and that hasn't happened. So that it looks like it will be staying in place. In terms of new policies, there are two main new policies which have been unveiled. The first and the most dramatic is a junk food advertising ban. And that's junk food in inverted commas, because the UK's definition of junk food seems to include some items that wouldn't necessarily be thought of as inducing obesity, such as Marmite, I think tinned fruit, yogurt, mustard, some quite random items that are categorized as being high in fat, sugar, or salt. And so they need to have their advertising restricted quite harshly. The government last year conducted a consultation on this, and apparently, despite the outcry from the advertising industry and from various other industries as well, they have decided that the outcome of that consultation was that this is something that Britain wants and needs. Very conveniently, there was a report, or as it's being branded, an expose from a group called Bite Back 230, which is backed by celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, who's been campaigning on this issue for a long time, which was released just a few days before the government confirmed that it's going ahead with this policy, which effectively seeks to stir alarm about the amount of junk food ads that children in particular are seeing. I think the figure they quoted, the headline figure, was 500 adverts per second, which I suppose is across the UK's 12 million children rather than per child. But it's a policy that is incredibly intrusive, obviously, and is the last thing that the UK needs as we enter a period of post-COVID economic recovery. But it looks like that is going to go ahead, and it looks like we're very firmly on the train towards more state intervention in this area. And by the way, this policy, according to the government's own analysis, will reduce on average 1.7 calories from children's diets per day, which is about the equivalent of half a Smartie. And that is not according to some analysis from a skeptical think tank or anything like that. This is the government's own analysis of its own policy, has come to the conclusion that 1.7 calories a day is going to be the benefit of this policy, which obviously doesn't come close to balancing out the huge economic cost and the huge infringement on people's liberty and on companies just going about their business. My mum, when she's not working in a care home, runs a baking business out of her kitchen. And technically, it seems that this proposed law will criminalize the photos that she posts on her Instagram of her cakes to promote her business, which is quite extraordinary that this is the point we've come to.
Yeah, and I think, you know, basing it on what the effectiveness they want to have with this, I mean, there's a bunch of things that children and young adults do that aren't being advertised. You know? there's a certain drug problem with young adults, but you don't see them advertised. So it's not by making it disappear that people reach a conclusion that they ought not to take it. Now, outside of advertising bans, there's also some taxation rules that the UK is considering or has already implemented. Give us some overview over that. So how exactly does that work?
So the sugar tax in its current form focuses on soft drinks, although I'm not optimistic that it will stay that way. It seems like we're on the road to more intervention, not less. But at the moment, we have some data on that because it's been in place for a couple of years now. And put quite simply, it doesn't work. When people are faced with the fact that sugary drinks cost more than they did last week, the analysis shows that their behavior changes in different ways. For instance, they sometimes switch to other high sugar, high calorie drinks like fruit juices. Sometimes they switch to cheaper own brand versions of the sugary drinks they like, which offsets the price difference, or they just fork out and pay the higher prices. So actually taxing sugar seems to have very, very little effect on the amount of sugar and the amount of calories that people consume. And you can see that from the fact that obesity has continued to increase in the last few years, despite this sugar tax being in place, and there hasn't been any dent in it. And this in addition, of course, to the fact that it hits the poor disproportionately hard. In a year when we've seen thousands and thousands of people becoming unemployed as a result of lockdown, the last thing we need to be doing is making people's weekly shopping trips more expensive.
Yeah, and I remember I've talked about this quite a bit. I think it was in 2012 when Denmark introduced this saturated fat tax. And the researchers found a certain drop right after the tax was introduced of consumption. What actually happened was that people stockpiled, but going across the border to Germany, which is a privilege that many Danish people have, of course. And what people did is they changed some of the consumption to the lower quality brands, so they would keep their fat consumption but actually downgrade on the quality of the product. So this is also something that we need to realize, is that
changing diet is not just about, you know, what you decide to do in the shop at that moment. It's also like you get a habit of a certain consumption. So my question basically is, Jason, we know that obesity is an actual problem. It's a genuine health problem. And we know that the ways of the government haven't quite worked, you know, with advertising bans and sin taxes. It's also very patronizing, but it doesn't it's not effective, and it actually disproportionately hurts low-income households. So what, in your view, are actually solutions to this problem? How can we tackle this without the top-down proposals that we see from the government?
Well, there is, as you say, there is no need for the government to be intervening in this way, and they always, these policies always produce more costs than any benefits. As is so often the case, innovation is the solution to this, if we can say solution in inverted commas to obesity. Other policies that have been tried around the world in other countries have been incredibly successful. There was a scheme in Iceland where they tested out a policy of rebranding healthy foods, fruit and vegetables in particular, to be called sports candy, which is a reference to a children's TV show called Lazy Town. And that something as innocuous as that had a huge effect on the amount of fruit and veg that kids were consuming. There was a study in the US which tested out a policy of putting yellow tape along shopping trolleys to indicate that a certain part of the trolley should be used for fruit and veg and another part should be used for other foods. And that increased sales of fruit and veg in those shops by over 100%, just by something as simple as tape on trolleys, which doesn't have the huge costs of new taxes or new advertising bans. And even when there isn't centralized policy like that, we see again and again that when there is an issue that people care about privately, it is in private companies' interests to go out of their way to do something about it. We saw that with climate change, for instance. When the world woke up to climate change over the last few years, we saw so many companies signing up to very costly net zero plans to reduce their carbon emissions. And the same thing is happening with obesity as people are becoming more and more aware, especially because of COVID. In the UK, for instance, the most recent example was Tesco, which is one of the three largest supermarket chains, has, under pressure from both customers and from its own shareholders, promised to boost it and set some ambitious targets for boosting its healthy food sales. It's going to make 65% of all of its food sales healthy foods. I think it's by 2030 is the target, which is much, much more ambitious than a lot of the other supermarkets. And so they're under pressure now to compete with that as well. Because when you have these public-facing brands like this, it makes sense. It's in their interest to do everything they can. Another policy, another proposal that's been floated, not policy, for supermarkets to enact is just moving confectionery away from the tills, from the checkout, so that people aren't tempted to pick up chocolate on their way out. And in studies, again, this has shown that it's very, very effective in reducing the amount of unhealthy foods that people are buying without infringing on their freedom and without taxing them. And these are things that the private sector is beginning to embrace. And so there is simply no need to make life much more difficult for people from Whitehall, from centralized policy.
Yeah, I agree. It's a genuine function of politics that you want to do something about a problem. And I think that's all of the expectations that many voters have. So when they see a problem, they look towards the government to try and solve it in one way or the other. And the problem is that many government solutions are very intrusive. Just as a concluding point, Jason, I just want to get your sense, because we are all about consumer choice, obviously. And we talked quite a bit about personal responsibility and the and sort of the solutions to the problem. But of course, you know, most people don't have a dietary problem. Most people actually get along very well in their lives. And how do you think how are those people, like you and me, affected by the patronizing policies of the government? Not only from like sort of a financial perspective, but like, what does it tell us about how we're treated by the government? Like, what is your view on the consumer choice implication of these sin taxes and so on?
Well, the problem with this kind of policy is that it states a very clear view of what the role of government should be in everybody's lives. And it means that when there is another area of policy that does perhaps affects a greater number of people than obesity does, the government will feel entitled to do whatever it wants to solve the problem, just as it did with obesity. You can very much understand Boris Johnson's mentality and where it's coming from, because he sees that he overcame this great obstacle in his personal life, and he wants to be seen as the leader who swooped in to save Britain from this new health plight, when of course that's not how real life works. The way real life works is that when society overcomes things, it's because huge numbers of people decide to overcome them themselves, and because with the help of big companies and things like that, it is never top down from government. And this kind of view from government is very, very common. And as we know, it's very destructive, because it represents, when you have a Conservative Party in government doing this kind of thing, it tells ordinary people like you and me that we are not capable of making our own choices. We are not capable of living our lives as we want to. And we need to have somebody who knows better tell us what to do. And in fact, going further than that, forbidding us from seeing certain advertisements, or punishing us through punitive tax measures when we buy the wrong products. So it's easy to see in terms of policy how far that intervenes in people's personal lives. When it comes down to something as fundamental as your diet, as what foods you're eating, if they can interfere with that, they can interfere with anything.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Jason on Twitter at JasonReed624. Please give the Consumer Choice Center a follow on Instagram, where we host regular content for you to enjoy next to cat videos and whatever people are posting from their holidays. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have to learn.